a little bit of an introduction. Firstly, I don't know how familiar you are, if at all, with Buddhism and Buddhist monasticism, but just one or two things about it. Firstly, this is not an evangelical order, and indeed, I'm not allowed to teach anyone who doesn't make an express invitation to be taught, or if someone invites me to teach in a just disrespectful manner, it also be would not be allowed to teach. I have been a Buddhist monk in Thailand, mostly in the forest monasteries of northeast Thailand, since 1978, and so Thailand's very much my home. But this last week or so, I've been visiting monasteries in Northern California and Oregon, which are branches of the monastery I'm affiliated with in northeast Thailand. And yes, would anybody like to ask or discuss anything at all? I'm interested both to talk and listen.
I'm curious as to what it's like living on your own in isolation.
Backtrack a bit. We have an initial period as a postulant and as a novice living in community, and then what we may call an apprentice monk or a Navaka monk has to spend 5 years under a teacher. And then he is considered to be mature enough and to understand the life of a monk and to be committed enough to it to go off by himself or to visit other teachers. And the advice I give to young monks who sometimes get very inspired with the idea of a solitary life is that solitary life is only really suited to someone who doesn't have a lot of problems living in community. If a monk has a lot of personality conflicts with people around him and thinks that the answer is to go off and live in solitude, then he stops arguing with other people, starts arguing with himself for very long. It doesn't work. And so the a monastic a monastery is set up, like a practice monastery, a meditation monastery is set up so that within a calendar year, monks will have periods of intense group practice and then other periods where they'll be by themselves so that they can see and either idolize, not idolize either one way or the other, but to have that kind of fluency and being able to function and benefit from whatever situation they might be in. The monastic discipline was set up by the Buddha in such a way as to prevent monks from becoming complete hermits. For instance, any food or drink that I consume has to be given into my hands by a non-monk. So even if you were to put something down there and say, "Help yourself," I couldn't. Or I couldn't take fruit off a tree or pick it up off the ground. So this one rule means that I have to have at least a minimal contact with the lay community every day. Monks also not allowed to dig the earth, not allowed to store food overnight. So can't just get a big sack full of food and put it somewhere. And the idea is that monks are the spiritual and moral leaders of society, in a Buddhist society, and are embodying the values that they teach, inspiring people by their way of life as much by formal teachings. So there is a very close and symbiotic relationship between the monastic order and the community in which it lives and functions. And monasteries are considered to be very much, even though forest monasteries are usually at least say, a mile, 2 miles away from the village, they're still considered very much part of the local community. And give you an idea of a daily, the day in the life of a monk in the forest monastery. The bell would go at 3 a.m. And then the monks would live in little cottages dotted throughout the forest. They come together in the main Dhamma hall. There'd be a period of chanting and meditation until about 5 a.m. Then there's a clean-up, and then the monks split into groups of 3, 4, depending on how large the monastic community might be, and then walk off into the surrounding villages on arms round. So in the villages of northeast Thailand, particularly, the first thing that somebody does, the lady of the house, the woman of the house, is to cook some sticky rice. And then she walks out the front door and meets her next door neighbors and says good morning, and they wait for the monks to come. And so arms round is, it's not begging, it's you're not allowed to beg anyway, but it's more of a ritual, and there are people in a line waiting for you, and it's their daily act of giving before they go to work, go out into the fields or whatever. And when I was first in Thailand in 1978, the conditions were very primitive, pretty tough life for everyone. And many of the people, you know, wouldn't. It was not a cash economy at those times; mainly a barter economy. Still, it's just the end of the barter economy period before electricity came, and so on. And what really impressed me was that people would not have food; they'd have rice. I mean, nobody has money, but everyone has rice. And so someone would have a plate of rice, sticky, big lump of sticky rice, and they look out and see how many monks are coming today, say 4 monks, and they make 4 portions, and they make a lump of it, and they put a lump in each monk's bowl. And the wonderful thing about that is that people are very poor by American standards, desperately poor, but everyone's perception of themselves is, I am a giver, I am someone who contributes in a very practical, tangible way to the monastic order and to the religion that I profess. So people have this sense of themselves as givers, not people who are deprived or lacking. And so there's a real sense of self-respect amongst the poorest people, which I think is attributable to giving and the way that we affect our perception of ourselves through the act of giving. So I went to Thailand as a young man, and I left home when I was 17 and hitchhiked to India and spent 2 years wandering around looking for what really a way to live what I thought was the best way of life, and eventually convinced that monastic life was what I was looking for, had the chance to come to Thailand. But when I first arrived, I think my idea of being a monk was like a professional meditator. Basically, yeah. I could meditate all day and all night, and someone will give me something to eat and a roof over my head. But then, as I, becoming part of the monastic order, I sort of so much richer than that, in that, you realize every single piece of cloth you wear, every single mouthful of food, the roof over your head, and medicines, everything that you consume and makes your life possible is provided freely by others. And you need a heart of stone not to feel this incredible gratitude and want to give something back to the society. And so as you get more senior, then start to take on more responsibilities and teaching and counseling and so on and so forth. And so I found that was a wonderful dimension of monastic life that I'd never considered before I went to Thailand. I'm getting off your subject a bit. Yeah. Very briefly, the difference between living as a meditator and in a community and alone are that there are different challenges. Basically, if you're in a monastic community, you have this constant sense of community and brotherhood, and you have some very basic pleasures in life. Two of them, living with people who have a shared standard of behavior and conduct. And secondly, shared values and aspirations. So that's very supportive. And you have people at the same level of you and people who have more experience than you, and you have teachers and people who can give you guidance. So what that means is that there are also sacrifices and things that you give up to contribute to the well-being of the community and give up your private time for the community and certain social responsibilities, which means that, let's say, compared with living alone, it's difficult to go so high, but you also don't go so low. Okay, so it's sort of a leveling effect. Why it doesn't go so high is because, well, it's time for this to take place and that to take place, and you have a daily schedule that you have to conform to. If you're living by yourself, you want to meditate for 2-3 hours, sitting meditation, walk for a couple of hours, read a book for an hour and sit for an hour, so you can arrange your own schedule so that you can go much deeper if you're feeling really that things are really going very well and your meditation is very strong, then you don't have anything that you have to concern yourself with. The downside of that is if you do get into a slump and things start to go wrong, then there's nothing outside to sort of help to pull you up. You know, it's, you know, your own bootstraps, as it were, and that's, yeah, it's especially difficult as a monk because you don't have bootstraps, so you don't have I would say that the kinds of things that come up in community, you know, things like just normal things, any community, it's not a monastic community, not so different from any other community. You have people getting misunderstandings and getting upset with each other and hurt feelings and so on. So person, and especially in, I was the abbot of a monastic community for many years, in which there were as many as 20 different nationalities. So that's, you know, quite a lot of, you know, harmonizing there necessary. So alone then, kind of things that are more difficult. Let me rephrase that. In community, you're constantly being reminded that people don't look at you the same way that you look at yourself. So the sense of self perception, ideas you have about who you are and so on, become exposed again and again. So living in community is always a little bit uncomfortable, even in a monastic community of people striving for enlightenment. Whereas when you're by yourself, I know if you've done any kind of exercise like yoga or something, and you find you just naturally tend to do the ones you're good at more and more, and tend to leave the ones that you're not so good at aside. So suddenly you realize you haven't done that exercise for months, even though you never made a conscious decision to stop doing it, but it's just you're not very good at it. So we tend to move towards what we're good at and move away from what we're not good at. And this happens in every level of life, and it happens in meditation. So you find monks or nuns who spend a lot of time alone, they tend to be have very specific skills, of meditative skills, for instance. But then they tend to have like yawning sort of big black blind spots. You know, you think, how could someone who is so sensitive and so wise and so peaceful in this area completely be so completely ignorant of what's going on here? So it tends, unless you're very skilled, living by yourself has as many dangers and more subtle dangers than living in community.
Do you have any passions like literature or music?
I've always, before I became a monk, my great loves were literature and theatre. So I obviously had to give up theatre. And I gave up literature for many years, but since I've been more senior every now and again, I like to read a good book, enjoy good literature. I think also, probably some fellow monks would say, you know, you're just justifying this because a lot of monks don't read good literature. But I find that the ability to inhabit the mind, the life of people who lead very different lives than I do and think in different ways and have different values, it is very helpful for me in teaching, so that I do have a real sense of how to bridge my own experience and my own understanding of Dhamma with where people that I'm speaking to come from. And I find that also that, you know, literature is it embodies these virtues. I mean, as a monk, we're talking, you know, sort of disembodied virtues a lot of the time. But when you see in literature a hero or a heroine acting well despite all the pressures and temptations to act badly, and this is the kind of thing that I love in literature. And novelists tend to have a very very profound insight into the way the ordinary unenlightened mind works, which I'm interested. I've always been interested in the human mind and human behavior.
I wonder if you could make a few more comments or a few comments about the Wat Nanatan, about the international monastery. How many monks are there? And you mentioned that they come from all over the world. And sort of the place of that monastery in relationship to other more conventional Thai Wats, if you could.
Yes, well, the first Westerner Western monk who arrived in Ajahn Chah's monastery in northeast Thailand was Chan Sumedho, who's quite well known figure now. And this was in the mid 70s. And at that time, Ajahn Chah, a teacher, was just starting to have gain a reputation throughout the country. And he arrived and he walked into the monastery and Ajahn Chah said to one of the other monks, and sort of, I've seen him before somewhere. And the monks were really excited. They thought he had some kind of meditative vision. And they asked him if that was the case. He said, no, I think it was in a cowboy film I saw when I was a boy. Just like that, really big, blonde. So Ajahn Sumedho was the sort of the trailblazer, incredible endurance and, you know, just physically, but also cultural differences and language and so on and so forth. And once he was there, that this was in the mid 70s, this is a period where there were a lot of Americans, particularly in Southeast Asia, either through Vietnam War or else in Peace Corps. And Peace Corps workers tended to be very idealistic and interested in Asian culture anyway. So there were many of them becoming interested in Buddhism. And Ajahn Sumedho was American, a graduate of Berkeley University, and someone who proved you could do this as a Westerner. You could live in a jungle in northeast Thailand and live according to the discipline of a forest monk in the same way that monks have done for generations. And so it made it real and possible. And so within actually, it's early 70s, that would be. So the number of Westerners started to increase, to the extent that it started to be something of an issue in the monastery, because a lot of the Westerners who came, it was just such a huge departure from the normal, that they tend to get very highly motivated, very intense kind of people. Who sometimes were not so sensitive to Thai cultural norms. So there started to be a little friction as well. And so because of that, and also because I think that Ajahn Chah saw in the future that their monks training here would be going off to establish monasteries overseas, he felt it would be a good idea if the Westerners would have their own monastery and where the senior monks could learn how to teach and how to run a monastery, and, you know, both physical and spiritual aspects of that for themselves. And the monastery was established as walking. If you walk, it's a couple of hours walk away. It's a bit, if you go by road, it's a bit further. It's about five, six, 7 miles to the fields. And so it's near enough that he could come over, or if the abbot had some problems, he could just go over and visit, ask for some advice. And then after Rajan's Tomato had been there at Wat Nanachat for about 2-3 years, he received an invitation from what's called the English Sangha Trust, which had been established many years before with the idea of introducing the Theravada monastic order into England. And so he left and took monks with him. And then another monk took over, and so there were, that monk after a while left, another monk was there for a few years and then went to establish a monastery in Australia. And so things have kind of spread out. So now the Western or non-Thai community of disciples of Ajahn Chah is spread out throughout the world. So we have the main monastery of Wat Nanachat. There are monasteries in Australia, New Zealand, America, Canada, England, Germany, Switzerland, Italy. And so there's a movement between them. So it's not just Wat Nanachat, as it were. And, so now monks who begin their training in America will go for like a sabbatical year or spend a year in Wat Nanachat, learning sort of the more traditional way of the training. And monks from Wat Nanachat may be coming to the West for a year or two. So there's this movement. So the general, there are, Wat Nanachat now itself has two branch monasteries. One in the same province, just on the banks of the Mekong River, which is a more of a hermitage, where there's not so much of a group ethos, and monks have more time for their own practice. And then we have another monastery way hundreds of kilometers to the west on the Burmese border, and that's in fact the monastery is within the national park area. And there's a scheme whereby monks can go and live in national parks and establish a sort of basic minimum of buildings. And it's kind of like a win-win situation. The monks can go and experience kind of solitude and living in the thick forest, which is what forest monks like doing. And for the forestry commission, it helps to conserve the forest because there's a lot of illegal cutting of trees. But when monks go there, a lot of people will not go close. They have that respect for the sangha that they don't have for the government. So we help each other in that way. And so two or three months of the year, usually in the hot season, the monks go in there and they just camped out under the trees with their umbrellas on a little platform. And bathe in the stream and just live a very simple life. And there are still elephants and tigers and bears there. So, you know, you really feel like you're living the life of the monk that the Buddha himself and his great disciples live. So monks will spend some time at Wat Nanachat, some time there, some time with other in monasteries run by Thai disciples. So they can learn how to live in the Thai community and the language and so on. So it's a whole sort of community of monasteries rather than just one place.
So you were talking about like you can't grab a like fruit from a tree and something like that. So do we have a lot of rules which you can't do?
Yes. Hundreds, hundreds and hundreds. But my analogy to give you, because that's when you hear rules, that sounds like wow, But my analogy, perhaps to help you understand it, is if you were, let's say, one of my favorite exercises is trying to imagine explaining things to a Martian. So like this really super intelligent person from another world who has no background or nothing, and just try to explain anything that you use and experience in your daily life. It's a really good way of re-examining assumptions you have about things. So I like to do this a lot. But so, imagine that you had to explain what driving a car is to a Martian, who probably has a flying saucer, but he doesn't know what a car is. And just consider how many rules you have to keep every time you drive a car. There's a highway code, but there are all kinds of conventions and regulations. But you don't feel really tensed up, I've got to get in the car, I've got to keep all these rules. it's just kind of completely natural to you. But you are, in fact, conforming to many conventions and rules, and some of which, if you broke, you'd be punished. If you were to drive on the wrong side of the road, or you weren't to indicate when you turn left or turn right, and so on. So it's a bit like that. You know, you just absorb it and it just becomes completely natural after a while. And, you know, if I was to explain some of the rules, it'd sound a bit like Monty Python sometimes. But, you know, you don't feel that when you're living within it, within the order. And also, it's inspiring also that every single rule was laid down by the Buddha himself. So you feel this kind of real, just through very mundane daily activities, things you do and things you don't, you feel this incredible link with the monks of all the past generations and you're upholding. So there are kind of lots of rules about do's and don'ts, and there are conventions. Like in a monastery, we all have to learn how to make our own robes. So, and this robe is made of, we get, lay people offer white cotton, and then there's a special way of cutting this and a special pattern on it and a way of putting the hem on it. And then once the white cloth has been cut and sewn, then we have to make dye from the, do you know what the jackfruit is? It's a jackfruit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you get the heartwood of the jackfruit and you chop it into chips and you boil, it takes all night and you get a dye and then you dye. So this is a jackfruit dye robe. And it doesn't have a very good fixer in it. So the first couple of months, if it rains on it, or as soon as you get a lot of sweat on it, the color runs. And so it's quite, it's a lot of looking after. So there are rules concerning your robes and your bowl, all kinds of stuff. But, I mean, that's my analogy. It's like driving a car and don't feel it's, you know, sort of in prison.
So I don't know too much about Buddhism, but I was wondering to what degree the beliefs and the spirituality of it is changing. There's always new interpretations of some different practices, or is it static? And new,
it's a very good question. I mean, just to give you a very brief kind of overview of how I understand Buddhism, I would group the religions that grew up in the Middle East, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, as a family of religions. And if we were to sum that family of religions up for our Martian, I would say they're essentially belief systems. And I think the fact that we use the word religion and faith almost interchangeably is a good indication of that. Mm-hmm. And this is why Buddhism is puzzling, because it's a different family of religions, and it's not essentially a belief system, it's essentially an education system. So it's a very different idea of what a religion is. It's a religion as an education of your conduct, of your heart, of your understanding of life. And if you were to pick up Buddha's discourses and compare it with the Bible or the Quran, it's a very different kettle of fish. You know, it's a very, you know, it's such a different feeling to it. There is analysis of sense perception, the relationship between thought and feeling, and all these kind of things that you would think would be in a psychology textbook, and other things that seem very philosophical, and other things that seem moral, and you know, how does all this stuff come together? It's puzzling. So my view is it's basically an education system, and for that, this is one of the reasons why I'm in. But part of my work in Thailand is trying to adapt this overall vision of Buddhism and employing Buddhist developmental principles in a conventional education system. Mm-hmm. As far as that's always going to happen in a, you know, you've got 60, 70 million people with all kinds of pressures and influences, many from the West and from other countries. But it's also noticeable because, as I mentioned at the beginning, Buddhism is not evangelical, proselytizing. Its attitude to other religions has always been, well, look, let's live together. You know, you do your thing, we'll do our thing, what's the problem?
Live and let live.
Pardon?
Live and let live.
Yeah, yeah. But because the Buddhism is, as I say, essentially an education system, if you have flaws in the education system, or the teachings are not being transmitted accurately or completely, then what tends to happen is it tends to absorb influences from other traditions without people quite realizing it. There was a famous conference many years ago in Thailand where the theme was the relationship between Buddhism, Brahmanism, and animism, which are the three main kind of streams in Thailand. And I wasn't there, but apparently the summarizer said, okay, Thailand's 100% Buddhist, 100% animist, and 100% Brahmanist. You know. So they're kind of all mixed up. And one of the roles of a monk is to say, look, you know, it's quite all right if you want to entertain animist beliefs or you have Brahmin beliefs, that's fine, that's completely up to you, but don't get them mixed up. This is actually what the Buddha said. So there's freedom of religion, you can believe whatever you want, but don't be careful not to get that mixed up with what the Buddha's teaching. So there are some weird and wonderful things, and some more worrisome than others at the moment. I would say that when I first arrived in Thailand in 1978, just starting to get like an urban middle class appearing and developing, and at that time the Western world and Western model of development was very much accepted wholeheartedly by that group of people, to the extent that, as in many other countries in the same on the same level of development, like there's a sense of contempt even or dismissal of the homegrown traditions, cultural and religious. And I was shocked when, as most Western Buddhists way into Buddhism has been through meditation, assuming in a Buddhist country everybody meditated, and then finding almost nobody meditated. And the question that people would ask me the most is it safe? You know, if you meditate, you go crazy. Yeah. And that was, I was such shocked, you know, but it's a bit like, you know, at the same time, you know, say, if you take LSD, when you jump out the window thinking you're a bird? You know? I mean, how many people actually did that? Maybe there were a few, but not many. And the number of people who meditated and went crazy. But this was a kind of the justification for dismissal of it. And that changed awfully, I mean, particularly in the last 10 or 15 years. And whereas when I was first teaching many years ago, now I'd get sort of middle-aged people saying, you know, how can I get my son or daughter to be interested in Buddhism? And now I get more and more people in their 20s and 30s saying, how can I get my mom and dad interested in Buddhism? Because they're in that kind of, from a Buddhist point of view, they're in this kind of lost generation, you know, the sort of the material, sort of superficial material generation. It's their sons and daughters now who are interested in learning about Buddhism, not as a sort of a cultural form to condition their external life, but as a means of self-exploration, self-understanding, self-development.
What is your sense of Buddhism in the West? In America? The Theravada.
Yeah, I don't think I'm probably not really qualified because I have such a narrow, direct experience. You know, I come here and I sort of visit friends and monasteries and people that I know. So in the groups that I am involved in, I'm very impressed, actually. One of the things we do in Thailand is we do something called Tudong, which means we just set off out of the monastery and we just walk. And because we have to have our food offered, it means you have to make sure you're within 5-6 kilometers of a village. So in the morning you can go on alms round, so you get fed every day. And this is a very old tradition in Asia, in Buddhist countries. Now, you would not think that it would be possible to do that in America, but we're doing it. And two of my friends just walked from Northern California to Oregon, 600 miles. Just two monks in the morning walk into a town or a village and stand there with their bowls. And in the whole of like 60, 70 days, it was only 2 days when nobody gave them anything to eat. And this is America, you know, have monks doing this in Europe and all over the world now. And people see monks and something happens. They just, often what will happen is someone will come up and want to give you money. And you say, I'm sorry, I can't accept money. I'm not allowed to touch money. And yeah, that's kind of weird to start. Yeah, but it's inspiring. You know? And they said, well, what are you doing? What do you want? I said, well, all we need is something to eat. Just eat one meal a day, and this is it. And often people say, don't, just stay there. I'll be back. And someone, you know, goes into the cafe or goes into the supermarket, comes out with a bagel or, some bread and cheese or something. People just enjoy giving so much. So as a monk, you know, if you are spreading Buddhism, that's how you do it. You don't go and have you read this book or something like this? Just walking, if people are interested, they can come up and speak to you. So I've just come today from a little town in the Columbia River Gorge, about an hour's drive east of Portland, where we have a monastery there. And this is very inspiring because the monks went there without any lay stewards or anyone. Usually to go and live somewhere, you need that. And a group of lay Buddhists rented a little cottage for them on top of a hill. And so every day they walk down, it's like 2,000 feet down, walk through the town of White Salmon, and then walk 2,000 feet up again. And within a short time, so many people were putting food in their bowl. And now, you know, with 3 years gone by, I was walking. They don't do 2,000 feet now. They moved down a bit, but still, it's a two-hour walk every morning. And I don't think a single person who drove by didn't put up their hand and say good morning. Kids in the school, you know, it's like the monks. Oh, there are the monks, you know, good morning. And just, it's quite, for me, really heartwarming to see a small community of Buddhist monks completely integrated and accepted in an American
I'm so sorry that I came in late to the talk. So if you already covered this, then definitely don't answer it. But what really drew me to your talk today is that I'm working on a project all semester about fundamentalist Christians and how they have political beliefs and then whether or not they act on those through political action versus just having fundamental beliefs. So I was wondering if you could kind of talk a little bit about the tension between those two, like having beliefs but then not necessarily kind of acting on them, and to what extent, and this kind of goes a little bit to what you were just saying about like kind of integration into community, like to what extent do you think religion and society have to be separate to keep religion kind of pure? I don't know if you are.
There's sort of a number of different ways into that. Firstly, I was just now saying, you know, I see Buddhism as essentially an education system rather than a belief system, and from a Buddhist point of view, one of the inherent problems in belief systems is you automatically get us who believe and those who don't. And so what is the correct relationship you should have to people who don't believe what you believe? And if you believe the only people who are going to go to heaven are the people that have your beliefs, is it irresponsible to let them go on believing what they do believe? And if you should try to get them to change their religion, then to what extent should you go? And does the end justify the means? And in the part of the world where I live, you know, the behavior of missionaries is tending to be what I would call unethical. You know, you get given free scholarships, free medical care if you'll just change your religion. So this is kind of normal in many countries throughout the world, where Christian missionaries particularly believe the end justifies the means, and even though the means by which they get people to convert may seem to be unethical, well, in the big picture of things, it's okay. In the Buddhist, it's not a belief system. So in Buddhism, we say, yeah, if somebody wants to go to heaven, let's speak on that level, then it's dependent on how they live their life, on their actions. So if someone is kind, gentle, has integrity, honesty, is generous, whether he's a Buddhist, a Christian, it's those virtues within his heart which are the causal factor for rebirth in heaven. It's nothing to do with what conventional religious identity you have. So Buddhists have never had any problem with, you know, if they see Christians doing good things, you know, and same with Muslims. So there's not that sense of us and them, and we've got to sort them out, or we've got to help them and save them, or whatever. In a Buddhist, Theravada Buddhist, the ideal has always been that the monastic community is that which harmonizes and binds. And the idea is people come into the monastery, and at that moment they cease to be rich and poor, and right wing and left wing, and they're just Buddhists for the time they're in the monastery, and that they're students of Buddhism. And this, in particularly in Thailand, that's an idea that hasn't always worked out, but I would say generally, monks have been able to create contact and community and understanding between people from different social classes and different backgrounds who would never come together in that kind of way otherwise. Buddhist monks are not allowed to participate in political activities as such, or to have any affiliation with a political party, for a number of reasons. One would be that if the monastic order was to become identified with a particular political program or political party, then all the people who were affiliated with other political parties would feel alienated from the monastic order. And perhaps if the other political parties were to come to power, they might seek to use that power to suppress the monastic order, to pass laws which made it more difficult to go to monasteries and so on. And so for the long-term stability of the monastic order, it doesn't make political sense, apart from, you know, any ethical or moral considerations, to take specific political stances on any issue. Nevertheless, monks do have a duty, a responsibility to be expounding and to be clarifying Buddhist positions on a more general level on the issues of the day. But it has to be expressed in a more general terms, rather than saying that monks are for this or against that. But, you know, we say in Buddhism, there is no, we don't have a concept of the end justifies the means, and that there is no, that the Buddha is very clear that any act of violence, no matter what the justification might be, is an act of bad karma. And so you lay down the basic principles and then allow people to apply them or adapt them to particular circumstances and situations. Now, that's the ideal, and that's been more or less upheld in Thailand throughout the centuries, and primarily because of the unbroken monarchy. So there's always been a symbiotic relationship between the monarchy, Buddhist monarchy, and the Buddhist monastic order. Now, where you see a difference is in Burma and Sri Lanka in particular, which were colonized and pressed, and the governance taken over by European powers meant that the close relationship between the secular power and the religious power was sundered, and so then everything started to fall apart in Burma, and Sri Lanka. What happened was that monks always have been seen as the leaders of the society in moral, spiritual, almost every way. And so when the independence movement started to gather momentum, inevitably they looked to monks for leadership. And so in Burma and Sri Lanka particularly, monks were at the forefront of driving out the British. And once they gained independence, the monks didn't relinquish that role. And by that time, the Buddhist perception of monks as being legitimate leaders of political protest had been firmly established. That perception has never been established in Thailand. So we had a kind of strange situation a few years ago, if you remember, when the monks in Burma were leading the protests against the military government, and people all over the world were expressing support for them. And yet in Thailand, there was this sort of this strange silence.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this was because for most Thais, they're kind of feeling, they feel sorry for the monk. It's just to see a Buddhist monk being beaten or something, it's incredibly awful thing to see. But at the same time, most Thais are thinking, well, what are they doing there in the first place? They're monks. That's not their role. They're doing things that monks shouldn't be doing. So it's like they're putting their hand in the fire. So this was a sense that monks are strayed out of the role, which is appropriate for them. And that where is this compassion for the monks? There's not this, this sense of outrage that people were feeling in non-Buddhist countries.
What are the differences between the men and women who wish to dedicate their lives to Buddhism? Is there a difference in...
Yeah, it's different. It's not a very satisfactory situation. The Buddha established a monastic order for women, a nun's order, but after about 1,000 years, which is, for any kind of institution, that's quite, respectable duration, it disappeared for one reason or another. And so when Buddhism, the present form of Buddhism, established itself in Southeast Asia, in Thailand and Burma, then it was led by the monks. So that what that means is that in Southeast Asia, at least, there's no kind of cultural memory or this idea of a golden age where there were monks and nuns together. Over the years, in every country, there have been attempts to create a quasi nun's order, something which is sort of acceptable and provides a monastic life and training of one degree or another for women. It's not really always been so successful. And in Thailand, the order is called the Order of Mechi. They wear white. That order, in fact, over the past several years, has transformed itself. But it wasn't really respected in Thai society very much because it's got a stereotypical view. It's either old ladies who like widows or people who have no one to support them, and it's a safety net, social safety net. Or else and this is the sort of the somewhat demeaning stereotype, young women with broken hearts and that kind of rather negative perception has now changed because there are now some very good schools in which these white robe nuns are being very getting all the academic qualifications, monastic Buddhist academic qualifications. There are hermitages with the nuns' communities meditating out in forests like the monks, and people in general are now looking at them with a lot more faith and inspiration. So that's generally a good story, but nevertheless, if we're looking on the level of status, they don't have the same status as monks. But for most of the monks, most of the nuns you speak to say, that's not really important to us anyway. In the last several years now, there's been a movement, strongest in Western countries, to try to revive the original nun's order. But there are a lot of difficulties entailed in doing that, and they are difficulties embedded in the instructions of the Buddha himself. And yeah, this is a big. I don't probably spend too much time on this, but basically, the Theravada order is 2,600 years old, and it's a conservative order, and generally. People think we've lasted this long because of conservatism. This is our brand, if you like. We're the conservatives. And we don't have the right to say that, you know, we should change things in a way that the Buddha has not approved or of which he seems to disapproved. And there's a fear that if one group of monks or one group of Theravada Buddhists make some kind of radical change and then others don't accept it, then the whole structure will start to split and it'll be a slippery slope. And that's the kind of conservative argument against this, the revival of the original order. For those in favor of it, there's this view of monks that just want to hold on to their power and their status and they're afraid that women are going to take that away from them, and they're just making excuses. And so I think you just have to read up and see which side of the argument you feel is the right.
You said that when you enter the monastery, you have to let go a lot of ties to modern society. Mm. And with a Western background, did you find that a difficult thing to do?
Personally, I didn't. In fact, I jokingly said my standard of living went up and became a monk. You know, I spent a couple of years as a hippie, traveling around India, pretty austere kind of life. So I just had this real conviction that this is what I want to do, and I'm willing to make sacrifices that make it possible. Just felt so grateful that I could live this life. We're generally speaking, these days, big problem in monasteries, and I'm speaking with abbots. I was in a big meeting, and I've seen, I've been a monk 35 years now, and it's sort of the up-and-coming abbots of Thai monasteries, like monks in their late 30s, early 40s, and asking them about sort of a straw poll, what kind of difficulties, what are your main problems, what are your worries for the future? And almost all of them talk about technology, and particularly young monks in his 20s have grown up with smartphones, mobile phones, so it's not like an extravagance for them. It's like sort of an extension of who they are. So for them to give up their smartphone is a huge renunciation. And a number of them smuggle phones in, or their mum or their dad smuggles a phone in. This is a huge distraction, if you have that ability to get online or to get in touch with somebody or to distract yourself. Because the most important thing you're learning as a monk is non-distraction, how to just to be alive and present without having to constantly run away from your existence as a human being with doing something or thinking something all the time. And it's a real challenge. But if you have that temptation always there, you can just press a button or do something. It makes it incomparably more difficult. And yet senior monks are worried that there are fewer and fewer young people coming to the monastery. And if you make things too strict, nobody's going to come and the monasteries are going to wither away and die. So they start making compromises. And then start to feel uncomfortable about the compromise. So it's a big, big challenge in monasteries right now.
I'm curious about the thing you've been holding the entire time. What is that?
Oh, it's a watch.
Okay. Can see it.
Nothing very mystical. Usually I put it there when I'm giving a talk to make sure I keep to the time.
Question. So is this form of Buddhism very much about a sort of self-enlightenment, or is it, are you supposed to spread it to, I understand you don't teach it, per se, or evangelize, but how do you do reach out to people?
Yes, well, the teaching is expressed in that show for your own welfare and happiness and for the welfare and happiness of others. That's the overall goal. And the idea is that those two things have to be pursued in harmony. Professor, I'm sure you're familiar with people who are very sincere, want to do something for the world and really, and then, you know, after a few years they're completely burnt out, or else many NGOs and you just get all these really strong egos and people and, you know, just fighting each other all the time. So the Buddhist view is that wish to help others is a wonderful thing, but to make it sustainable and to make it really effective, you also have to be doing this inner work, working on your own sense of importance, your own desires and fears and anxieties and so on. And that without that, then, in fact, no matter how well-intentioned you are, the good works you do will be very limited.
So as living in forest communities, I understand you go to villages or towns in the mornings, but is that not limiting? But
well, in the monastery, we have this. In the monastery, uses a lunar calendar rather than the solar calendar, and so you have like a full moon day and a dark moon day, and then they have between them. So it's like a Sabbath. It works out more or less once every seventh or eighth day, but it's decided by the moon rather than the day of the week. And in the monasteries. On that Sabbath day, people from all the surrounding villages and sometimes in the town will come to the monastery in the morning, and the abbot will give a talk. And many people who are retired or who just take the day off, and they stay in the monastery all day. And then in the evening, there's a chant together with the monks, and there's a talk and meditation, and people stay right through the whole night. So mostly the older people who have the time, they just spend 24 hours of every week in the monastery. Other people will come once every 2 weeks, depending on. And people are coming for periods of retreat. Anyone can come spend the night. It's free. There's accommodation for men and women to come and stay. And also, there are other occasions when, if there's the forest monks, we do a lot fewer ceremonies and things, but one thing that we do is counseling and chanting and dealing times of death. So we have, in fact, many forest monasteries, including Wat Bananachat, is built in what we call a cremation forest. So most villages, when they start clearing all the land, would leave a patch of forest, say a couple of miles, a mile to 2 miles away from the forest. And that's the place where all the cremations would take place. So you have a ready supply of wood, but also, importantly, all the spirits, are like a decent distance, because it's very strong animist influence at times. People are very afraid of spirits. So for monks, these cremation forests are like favorite places. You know, you have a forest, it's cool and shady. And it's a walkable distance to the village, but because of the spirit, people don't come and bother you. So, that's how our monastery began. Monks came to stay in that forest and then stayed on, and the village people sent a deputation. We would like you to stay and build a monastery here. We'll build you cottages if you would agree to stay. And that's how monastery starts. So even to this day, when one of the lay supporters dies, then the monks go into the local village and gives a talk and give some counseling and do some chanting, and then the body is taken back into the forest, into the monastery, and then we cremate it there, and so the cremations take place in the monastery.
So
first one is. Now I'm a sort of in many ways this mixture of traditional and high tech, in that I've last 11 years I've been living completely by myself, but I give these talks twice a month on a Sunday, and it's quite. I live about 100 miles outside of Bangkok, and most people are working like 6 days a week or 5 days a week. So to begin to join in this program, people have to leave on their 1 day a week. They have to leave Bangkok for about 5 o'clock in the morning, 6 o'clock, and people drive up, and we have a period of chanting and a guided meditation, and I give a talk, and afterwards I sit and talk to people for as long as they want me to, usually, and there's usually 200 people come up, drive up from Bangkok, and this is there's a video, it's videoed and put on YouTube the next day. There's audio, it's made and made into CDs, and then the national TV come and make a recording. It goes out on national TV. So I don't have to do anything more than I do otherwise. And then Duk and Dun and one or two others, they have an Ajahn Jayasaro Dhamma teaching Facebook page that they do every day. So every 6 o'clock in the morning, there's a new reflection that they do that for me. So I'm living in a very secluded way, but I have this very good feeling that I'm doing something for society. But it's in a way that I feel is appropriate for a monk, that I'm not compromising the way of life or the kind of example of the monk, I should say.
This is a kind of a hard question to answer, but I feel like my sense is that with Buddhism, with other religions, part of what you're trying to get out of it is to see the world or that which is around you as it is, you know, kind of good and bad, you know, what John Keats called negative capability. So I guess my question is, as the world becomes way, way more complicated and integrated, we have all of these kind of, you know, ways of interacting online and, you know, not face-to-face, is it harder to grasp? Is it harder to kind of just see everything for what it is?
Yeah, I mean, negative capability is one of the best ideas that's come out of Western culture, in my view. It's very similar to Buddhist teaching.
Can you elaborate on it a little bit?
Well, the idea is you can see two poles at the same time without jumping to one of them. Okay. You know, you can remain kind of this constant state of tension. Intellectual attention, you're okay with that. Yeah, I think it's really important for artists to have that, because you know, you're not seeing everything from one kind of, you know, one kind of extreme perspective, but you're kind of absorbing everything at once.
Mm. Yeah, that's pretty good. I mean, from Buddhist point of view, it's just being able to be at peace with ambiguity. That would it's very important to have a certain time of the day where you just put everything down for a while, not just when you're asleep, but a time where you're just with yourself as a body, breathing in and breathing out. And if you can have some experience of stillness and clarity, and inner well-being, independent of external stimulation or triggers, that gives you a really good perspective on all of the complex nature of stuff that you have to deal with every day. There's a lot of, where Eastern religions talk about being in the present moment, but that's not a goal in itself. It's not a mystic goal, be in the present moment. Speaking in Thailand, I always say the present moment is the classroom. This is where it's only when you're able to dwell in the present moment and sustain attention in the present moment that you can learn from life. And you can learn what's helpful, what's unhelpful, what really makes you happy, what doesn't. but rather than being just caught up in ideas and desires and fears, just being right there and present to what's going on. So most meditation techniques, the first stage is developing the ability to sustain attention in the present moment in order to be able to look at ourselves in a non-discursive way. And we find that just things just start to arise up. It's like we have all this wisdom inside, you know, but it's just so much going on, we can't hear it. You know, you just have to turn that down a bit. And then you become aware of, you know, that really is not what I want to be doing. As our ability to communicate with others increases exponentially, it's our ability to communicate with ourselves, you know, becomes more and more atrophied. And I think that doesn't have to be that way. And that being disciplined enough just to give yourself a few minutes every day at least, just to put everything down and all your identities as a student or as a friend or as a son or as a husband or boyfriend or girlfriend or whatever, and just be, rather than always doing. You know, I think that's a really important part of a healthy life, and making choices when there's just so much pulling you in every direction.
I'm wondering how the process to become a monk begins. For example, is there some age you have to be of to be able to enter? And what was your biggest challenge?
To become a Buddhist monk, you have to be 20 years old. But you can become a novice from the age 12, 13 onwards. And in Thailand, many boys will become novices in their school holidays. There's a lot of monasteries run these programs, like 1 month novice ordinations. It's a big. In fact, last couple of years, one of the most popular reality programs on TV is like a group of boys who become novices in the monastery. They follow them throughout the whole of their time in the monastery, and it's 24 hours. Generally speaking, in Thailand, it's far too easy to become a monk. A Thai person could become a monk within a couple of days of going to a monastery, which is, I think, a serious flaw. In my monastery or in Marsha's tradition, you have to go there and live there and learn about monastic life for some time before you take ordination, so you value it. And it's a little bit different, obviously, for Westerners who have a lot more new things to learn, language and cultural things and so on. So I myself spent 2 years in a monastery as a postulant in white, as a novice, before I became a monk. And that's in my tradition, that's quite normal. When you become a monk in a Buddhist this tradition, you don't take vows or you don't take lifetime vows. And you can leave at any time. And you don't even have to perform a ceremony to leave. If you just said, "I've had enough," that would be it. You'd be no longer a monk if the person understood what you meant. Most people, of course, prefer to do it in a little bit more polite, ceremonial way, but strictly speaking, it's not necessary. And there's no, there's no sense of shame or prejudice against someone who left the monastic order. In fact, anyone who's been a monk or none for even for a short period of time is given a great deal of respect in society. So in a monastic order of some, I know at any one time, maybe 300,000, there's probably only 5% or 10% of monks for all of their life. I have difficulty listening with a chat. You know, even amongst Western monks, who come with a lot of commitment, I just never wanted to do anything else. You know, I just took to it like a fish to water. I mean, I can't say I hadn't had any challenges at all. I just never wanted to do anything else, never had any interest in anything else except living as a monk.
Do you think these novice students that go into these monasteries,
do they have parental pressures?
Yeah.
Sometimes. I mean, since it's a respected thing to do, are there a lot of parents?
Yeah, but they tend to enjoy it, usually, also. It's good fun. For novices, there are lots of programs and activities, and, you know, it's not made too tough. It's more like the monasteries in the towns and the villages rather than the forest monasteries that do this. But family structure very different in Thailand than it is in the West, and very much closer and relation, expectations and, from of parents to children, children to parents are very different from here. So, you know, if you were to ask somebody, what did your parents put pressure on you to do this, they might say, well, yeah, of course they did. You know, that's what parents do. You know. Maybe I'll just give Dun a... Dun, you became a monk as a young man. You should say something about it, why you did it.
Okay. Actually, I would describe as my life-changing experience. Before, I was just like anyone. I went to school in Wisconsin. Actually, just at school, too. And I was working for like 10 years as a graphic designer. And I was just much into my career, you know, making money for myself, fame and everything. And a bit frustrated all the time. And I was never with myself. I never actually know myself at all until I became a monk. And the reason I became a monk was just get away from work. I didn't have any other reason than that, but I was lucky enough to be in a forest monastery and try to... one of the teaching was just to look within yourself rather than look what others have done, you know, and that's what I tried and found a lot of things that I never knew I had. Terrible things, actually. Judging people from my own perspectives, that kind of stuff, you know, and getting frustrated when things don't come my ways, and now I kind of can let that go, and it's a lot lighter life. And that's, for me, it's life-changing. I don't get frustrated anymore if things are lost, or get into traffic jams, or my client don't buy the piece that I preferred rather than the other one. You know.
Do you still live in the United States?
No, in Bangkok.
A lot more details than that. It's kind of uplifting for me. From your experience, it sounds like it was more of a rejection of society that you were living in that brought you towards Buddhism. Do you feel like most people discover Buddhism in that way, or?
It just varies so much. And say that in monasteries, when I was first there, you know, if you got a really difficult adolescent son or something who's really naughty, or you know, and you just run out of ideas, you go and give him to the monastery, say, ask the abbot to sort him out. So there's that kind of idea, but I mean the traditional idea in Thai culture has always been, this is again it's for men rather than for women, is that once you finish your education, before you start a career, particularly before you get married, you should spend a few months as a monk to get some real moral spiritual foundation to be able to make to use in your life as a householder. And to this day, every branch of the civil service in Thailand gives 3 months paid leave to anyone who wants to become a monk. So once in your career, you can take 3 months off to become a monk. So people still do that.
I just have a question. A recent speaker here at the speaker series that comes 4 times a week was James Fadiman. He was a he spoke about the use of psychedelics, and he's kind of an expert about psychedelics. And I was wondering, what is a traditional Buddhist approach or opinion on psychedelics and how that maybe affects attaining some sort of
Well, I can sum this up very, very easily because there's a monk, a German monk, who's sort of ex-hippie, and he was living in northern India in that whole period when I was in the 70s, where so many people were going over land. And he was asked this question, and I thought he gave a really good answer. He said, if you've got an ignorant mind, you take mind-expanding drugs, all you get is expanded ignorance. That would be the Buddhist. Having said that, a number of monks and people who have gone on to live say, quite spiritual lives in various various ways and various styles, I think would agree that for many of them, psychedelics in particular gave them the first sense of all this stuff taken for granted. You know, it's a conventional reality, or there's something more than this, or there's something beyond this. And for wise people, or people, they could say they see, but you may have a glimpse, you know, you could, through a drug, you may have a glimpse of a mountain way over there, and it's, wow, it's like lightning flash, and you see a mountain. But then when you, the drug's influence wears off, you're back where you are, miles, you can't even see the mountain anymore. And so the foolish person just wants to take more and more drugs so you can have more and more glimpses of the mountain. But then the other person said, well, there, I'm really convinced by this that there is a mountain, but how can I get there? Rather than just seeing it in a flash of light produced by a chemical. So there were many people who embarked on spiritual disciplines, having had an initial opening experience through psychedelics. And of course, Ram Dass, Richard Alpert, was one of the greats. He was at Harvard, one of the people who were doing all the experiments on LSD in the early 60s, and went on to become a very well-known spiritual leader and repudiated all of that once he found something that was more sustainable and more profound. There we
are.
Don't hold any game. I have a teaching engagement this evening. I'm just worried about the time.
Where are you going?
The University of the West.
Okay. You're talking about University of the West.
It's quite nearby. So I'm giving a lecture or talk in English this evening, and tomorrow is like a 1 day meditation retreat in Thai for the Thai community, and then Sunday morning of English.
Well, the car is ready whenever you are. Whenever you feel it's time.
Any more questions?
Can we get a few pictures with the students here? Yes. Do you have a camera, and can you send it to us?
Can I maybe ask what all of you are studying? What you're all doing here?
Yeah, I study history and government.
I'm doing international relations, but I'm not very sure.
Mm-hmm. I'm doing government and French and lots of yoga as well.
I'm probably doing economics.
Uh-huh. Government and religious studies.
Well, that's an interesting combination.
They're separate.
Yeah. Oh, international relations.
I'm doing government,
economics and history,
environmental analysis and media studies.
I applied for politics, philosophy, and economics, but it's an applications based major, so If I don't, if I'm not selected for that, then I'll study government and economics.
International relations and Middle East studies.
Economics and math. I'm just visiting here, actually. I don't actually go to school here.
Has anybody heard of a book called Sacred Economics? I've just been recommended to download this by someone in Portland.
Yeah, I downloaded it a couple months ago. I haven't got around to reading it. I read the first chapter and it was good.
Yeah.
It was about, the chapter that I read was about the idea that we should limit what we use. Mm-hmm. So there's a community. Mm-hmm. It should be more community-based. So why does everyone own a lawnmower? Mm-hmm. One community could own one lawnmower instead of everyone owning a single lawnmower. So it increases waste. So it's concepts like that.
Uh-huh.
Never talked about it.
I just thought of something. You mentioned that in your free time you like to read books. Is there anything, like, can you monks play sports or instruments or what types of things do you do?
Yeah, I mean, I don't do a lot of reading. I have to be quite disciplined about it because I do like it. No, we don't play sports, but I do practice yoga. I've practiced yoga since I was a teenager. One thing is, you know, I'm very aware as a monk that if I get ill, then my lay supporters are going to have to provide medical care for me. I don't want to be a burden on them, and if it's all possible. So I try to look after my health. Just a sort of a general, I think it's sort of something of interest to you perhaps, and that's the, often Buddhism is identified with this idea that we should get rid of desire, that desire is bad. But in fact, it's a bit more complex or sophisticated than that. Buddha said there are two kinds of motivation or two kinds of desire. So we divide this like wholesome desire and unwholesome desire. And the reason this has been kind of missed by most Western interpreters of Buddhism, because we don't really have this distinction in English language in the same way. But in Pali language, these are two completely different words. So Tanha, or craving, as it's usually called, is that desire which is rooted in ignorance of the way things are, and its fundamental feature is it's obsessed with the result. You want to get something. Basically, the wholesome kind of desire called Chanda arises from understanding of the way things are. And it is fundamentally the desire to do. So on a social or economic level, the Buddhist attitude is that we're not saying, you know, trying to get a point of no desire. But we're saying trying to channel the energy of desire into the chanda or the wholesome stream as much as is possible. A simple example, if you're working, and your main reason for working is to get money or status, then that means you're working with tanha. And the common results of that one is like shoddy work, because you don't care for the work itself, you're working for the result of the work, looking for shortcuts, and often dishonesty. Because if you can get what you want without having to go through all the hassle of working, then why not? Whereas with chanda, this word now does have an English expression. Maybe it's had it a long time, but intrinsic motivation. This is chanda, is where your effort is in the quality of the work itself and taking joy in the work itself. And that's not a unrealistic or a dreamy kind of, because you still get the results of the work if you're doing the work well. But it's that sense of respect and interest and looking constantly to work better and to find ways of increasing the quality of what you're doing. This is considered to be, in the long term, a much more sustainable engine for economic growth than the craving. And I think that, you know, we're seeing, you know, the results now of a economic structure based upon the craving kind of desire, and not any appreciation or any effort to try to stimulate the chanda or the intrinsic motivation kind. So would that seem reasonable to you, who know much more about economics than me? Yeah. The one more thing before I go is, and again, you may be familiar with this research. They had a group of students from Harvard, I believe, and they gave them like a psychological questionnaire, and sort of hidden within this, this is the point of the whole thing. It said, are you smart? Do you consider yourself smart? And then the students were led into another room and they were given a test, and they made it very easy to cheat. And there was like a hidden camera. And what this was really about was to see what correlation there is between cheating and perception, self-perception as smart. And they found like a quite disturbing number of the smart students cheated much more than the students who didn't consider themselves smart. And the conclusions they've drawn about it is that we have different ideas of smartness. And a damaging idea of smartness is to think that it's something you possess. Now, when you think like I am smart, then if you have any kind of exam coming up, you get really stressed out, because it's not just a test of your knowledge; it's a test of who you are. And if you fail the exam, then people who have this sense of I am smart tend to have a much more emotional turmoil than those that don't. Now, I like this because it very much conforms with the Buddhist idea of everything. What I say is everything's a verb. There are no nouns. Okay, so if you look at intelligence as a verb, and then you consider in terms of how can I have the most intelligent moments every day, you know, rather than I am intelligent, intelligence is something I possess. Praise, how do you praise children? You know, how do you motivate children? Again, if you just keep telling, oh, you're so smart. It's not really a very good thing for a kid. What you want to say is, wow, that's just really wonderful. You must have put so much work into that. There's so much care, so much effort that I can see in that piece of work. So you're praising the child for effort. So when a child or a student comes for an exam, he knows, I'm going to do well in this exam or not, depending on how much and the quality of effort that I put into it. And if he doesn't pass the exam, the child concludes that I didn't put enough or the right kind of effort, so I've got to put more effort. So this emotional resilience is arising dependent on this perception of smartness, or smartness as a possession, or smartness as something you do, or something that you try to manifest moment by moment, and that the essential point is effort and right effort. So I'd like to share that with all of you this evening, and apologies again for coming so late. We're usual things, plane delays, traffic, that kind of thing. So thank you for all being so patient, and thanks so much for the attention.
Thank you.